Hello, and welcome to episode 157 of the Planning Period Podcast, part of the On Podcast Media Network. I'm your host, Brad Scheffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Ryan Tibbins. Ryan is a high school English teacher out of Northern Virginia and the host of the ClassCast podcast, a self-described podcast about education for everyone, not just educators. He is also part of the Twitter podcast Learning Network I'm in, where I met him and asked him to be on the show. Ryan and I talk about his podcast and what it is, what learning loss really is or isn't, how a lack of flexibility in the system is the biggest problem in education, the importance of expanding your learning beyond your subject and education, and how sometimes a tough teacher can be the best teacher. So, sit back and enjoy episode 157 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Ryan Tibbins. Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Scheffler. And tonight, I did back-to-back interviews tonight. If you listened 2 weeks ago to the episode with Aviva, I was quite rusty. But now I've done an episode again, and I'm a professional all over again. So we're going to do this one full stop, no mistakes, just run it straight through. That's how we're going to roll. And I'm also excited to be joined by another fellow podcaster, Mr. Ryan Tibbins. How you doing, man?
Great. Thank you for having me. And I'm sure you're going to do a wonderful job, and I will help to knock off any rust that may have accumulated.
That's good. That's good. I was telling you before we started, I had gotten a bunch backed up, and I had a backlog, and I had gotten them all ready and released them slowly. And now I've been a month and a half since I've actually talked to anybody for the show. And it's like, I almost stumbled on my intro just now. Like, I've done it 156 other times, and I still almost stumbled on it.
Do you ever mess up on purpose?
No, I am not that coordinated.
I've done it at least twice where I can tell the guest is nervous and I promise them that I can edit things out. So I will intentionally screw up my own intro and then say, hold on, let me do that again. They laugh and it breaks all the ice. So
that's good. You know, that's good. I go the opposite route where I just don't edit. And whatever we say is going to be on the episode.
So. Duly noted.
Awesome. Well, Ryan, could you, for my audience, I know you are a fellow podcast host of the ClassCast podcast. I know you are an English teacher. But could you just, for my audience, give them an introduction to who you are?
Yeah. So my name is Ryan Tibbins. As you said, I host the ClassCast podcast, which is, cut a very wide swath through education, sort of big ideas, philosophy, policy, a little pedagogy. I am a high school English teacher. I'm in my 15th year. I work in Northern Virginia. I'm originally from central Pennsylvania. And yeah, that's pretty much it. On the side, I run a little tutoring business, do a lot of, essay stuff, college admissions, things like that. So between family, podcast, tutoring, and teaching, I'm a busy guy and I don't sleep enough, but I'm sure I'm not the only one feeling that way.
Yeah, no, I think at this point, all teachers feel that way, whether they have a side hustle or not. I think we're all kind of in that same boat right now. But you're also kind of a big deal in your town. Like you're kind of a thing.
I try to show it off that way. I assume you're referring to when I peaked a couple years ago, right?
Is that you're the 2019 Best of Loudoun, which, pretty cool. Minus the two U's, it's way more impressive, but of Loudoun is great.
yeah. So 2019 was coincidentally a good year, and it looks better on paper than it probably is. But I all in 1 year, I was best teacher in Loudoun County, which is a big county in Northern Virginia, about 30-40 minutes west of DC. And that was cool because that was voted on in the paper. So, a lot of people involved. And then I was also 40 under 40 and Loudoun 100, which is a list of just community influencers and things like that. What people don't realize is that that's all built on momentum. Like once you get one, it got easier to get the others because every one of those organizations is trying to, build their own brand or sell a newspaper, whatever it is. So, I allowed them to use me, and I've now peaked. You know, I told my principal, you know, he kept congratulating me. I'm like, buddy, look, long, slow decline into retirement now. Like, you've already gotten the best out of me. It's over.
Yep. Just ride it. Ride that wave the rest of the way. Awesome. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your podcast because I love podcasting. And if you listen to my show, you must at least enjoy listening to one of them. So I want to talk about podcasting and your show. You know, you describe your show as an education podcast for everyone, not just educators. And so what does that kind of mean to you? If I say asking a horribly phrased question?
Yeah, no, the real like kind of issue that probably led to some of the confusion in branding. Like I now in retrospect don't love the name of my podcast because it's so generic, you know, Class Cat, what does that even mean? Right. I had other ideas and I ran a poll with friends and this is the one that won. So I went with it, but I don't actually listen to a lot of podcasts. It was suggested to me by my students actually that I do this. They're like, you know, on occasional lecture days in class, I always know that they go well or discussion days go well because at the end of class, kids are like, you know, I would have listened to that outside of school. Like if you recorded that, I would just listen to that. And I'm like, well, hey, awesome. So I decided to do it. But my thought was there's a ton of podcasts already out there just for teachers. And while I think there's some value in it, I don't know that that's the place where I could add value. I think education is something that we do as a society. And sometimes we compartmentalize this too much. Like the idea of like, say, I just released an episode on like learning loss, right? And everybody has these different ideas like learning loss and what's going to happen in schools. And it's like, well, kids are always learning. Right. So education isn't limited to what happens in the classroom. And even within the broader school, I think most of what kids learn, you know, at least half of it comes from the cafeteria, the hallway, the school bus, and extracurriculars. Like you're not that the classroom isn't important, but that's not the end all be all of what we do to help develop young people. And so the idea of a podcast with sort of a broader audience is really, just sort of thinking about how do you connect, say, people in policy positions or researchers at universities with parents, with students, with fellow teachers, because in my opinion, a lot more people should be involved in the decisions we make or the way we do this. And so when I sit down in a faculty meeting and it's a room full of teachers, a few administrators, and that's it, like, I always feel like we should have some students and some parents in the room. Like, I feel like the conversation would be more honest. And so with my podcast, that's one of the things I try to do is hit topics that would appeal to, you know, not necessarily everyone at the same time, but has some appeal to anyone with an interest in education, because I think we should all be a little bit more involved in that process.
Hmm. Yeah, I can certainly agree. I mean, there's the general concept of like a community school that does exactly that and involves outside factors. But I also think just like as a principal, as a school leader, it's good practice to consider and involve the families and the students in decision-making. It's how you get buy-in into initiatives and a lot of other positive benefits, but also just common sense. Like this is the thing. It's not school. I don't think should be the thing we're doing to kids, right? Like it shouldn't be, that doesn't work.
And that is a lot, I think, of how this discussion tends to go when you talk about, you know, what are we doing in schools? How do we do it better? There's sort of this assumption that it's just going to happen because we're making it happen. And that might be true, but it goes way better when the kids feel like they're a part of it, you know, and sometimes that means providing a real voice in decision-making or a real choice, you know, in the classroom. And if we're being totally honest, sometimes it's just the illusion of it. Like sometimes people just need to feel like their voice is heard and you may not actually use it, but it doesn't mean that it's wrong to let people voice their opinion. And so when I think about how, so, you know, to me, not as an administrator, but, you know, as a classroom teacher, if I were to run a school, I think about how often I would seek input from other people and it would be a lot. I don't think I would use all of it, but I would continue to seek it because you never know, you know, where you're going to find that next piece of gold. And so I think that's part of my sort of mission doing the podcast is trying to bring in those extra voices or find something that appeals to someone who cares about education, but otherwise didn't feel like, you know, there was a show for them or there was a topic that they really wanted to hear more about. And it's trying to find some of those ideas to focus on.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I like that. You know, I listened to a little bit of your episode on learning loss and, you know, the gist I got was that it's a ridiculous concept. Like the idea is inherently flawed. The thing that I come back to with that same concept is like, we have literally any educator worth anything knows that what we do is make up gaps for the students that are behind and accelerate the students that are ahead. Like, that's what we did before COVID, and it's what we'll keep doing after COVID. Like, our jobs won't drastically change. If we literally stopped school for all of education for an entire year, which some people might argue we basically did, it still wouldn't matter. Like, we would still do the same things we did 2 years ago, which is figure out where the kids are at and teach them. Like, that's our jobs. Like, that's what we do every day. So this entire concept of learning loss is clearly not perpetuated by teachers in any way whatsoever.
Yeah, no, it's, I think that, not that the concept itself is automatically flawed. I mean, you know, we can have a talk about like that sort of summer slide and things like that, but it really is a way for people, I think, for whatever their personal agendas are or professional agendas are, to sort of cash in on the whole pandemic piece. Are kids learning less of the content? It depends on which class you're in and how you've been running it. But, you know, I think it's fair to say, at least in some cases, probably. But the reality is, I don't know that that matters. Like, I'm a big believer of the idea that school, that especially most of your public school or just K through 12, is sort of like going to the gym. You know, in 5 years, it doesn't matter if you remember a given workout. What matters is that you went and you kept working out. You know, it's not that every piece has to be memorable. You continue to build those skills, right? That people should always be working on their literacy and their numeracy, some critical thinking and rhetoric. I mean, I really think that that's most of what we really need to get from school. And that's not trying to poo-poo, you know, STEM subjects or technical skills. All that's really, really important. But I also think a lot of that is stuff that people are going to learn, say, in college and then on the job. So the reality is that when we say, you know, well, what are these kids going to do? They're 3 months behind. Well, one, 3 months behind what? You know, that was probably an artificial sort of goal anyway. Like, we're 3 months behind where we said they wanted to be. So really, we could just be flexible. And the idea that we say, no, we have to catch them up the 3 months. Really, what we're doing there is not protecting the students. We're protecting the school system from its own inflexibility. We can't let anyone know how rigid this is. So we've got to catch them up. So we make it look like the problem is the kid's problem. It's not the school system's problem. And so it's a framing issue, you know, and I didn't record that episode thinking, oh, I don't care if kids are learning. I just think it's a flawed discussion because it has a lot more to do with how we run schools or how people wish we ran schools than it does about individual student success.
No, I think you're right. And I agree completely with just, even if we considered behind what, right? But I think even, you know, you said, like, if we consider the concept of summer slide, well, sure, we've now documented summer slide, but it has been that way for 80 years. Like, mm-hmm. It's not like that isn't normal. So even still, like, like you said, it's people cashing in. To me, it's Pearson cashing in saying, well, they're not going to do well on our tests, so here's a new product that costs $50,000 to help them catch back up. Boom. We have our new learning loss mitigation program. Well,
and you know what? Enjoy. You know what's great? With all that, if you look, there, I think part of the new, I haven't read the details of it, but from what I understand, the new COVID relief bill that's about to be signed into law, a certain portion, I think it's like $120 billion. Don't quote me on the number, but it's a huge chunk of money that has to be used for essentially remediation and tutoring to address learning loss. So it's like, here's the money. Now you have to fix it. Well, now we have to use the money for something, right? And so this has been a mantra that I've been using since shortly after the pandemic hit, which is, if not now, why ever? You know, people say we can't grade kids. They're, you know, they don't know how to do this online, you know, let's say last spring. Well, sure. But if you can make the argument that grading is inequitable because we're online or because of a pandemic, at least for some, and maybe for a lot of your kids, it was inequitable in the first place. Like, there is no argument you can make that we should or shouldn't do something right now that we should or shouldn't have been doing all along. So if all of a sudden you're going to say, hey, here's extra money falling from the sky so that we can put kids in small groups and, you know, essentially set a teacher up as the private tutor. If you really think that's the best thing to get results and you're serious about education, you would have been doing it all along and you'll keep doing it in the future. If this is a one-time, have your money, catch the kids up for 3 months and we're done, then you either didn't really care about their learning or you don't really care about education that much, because if you think that's what works, you would do it all the time. Right. So I think that a big part of what we're seeing with the pandemic is a lot of people are sort of being exposed for sort of that. I don't want to say it's hypocritical, but we say one thing, you know, one time, and we turn around and change the story another time. And I think that's why a lot of parents are frustrated, you know, with whether it's being online or the changes in schedules. More people are paying closer attention, and we're realizing that a lot of people aren't being consistent or honest with what their goals are or with how we're applying our resources. And so all of this just sort of gives us the opportunity to more closely examine what are the priorities and how do we go about achieving those goals. And when we see those inconsistencies, those are the places that I like to focus in.
Yeah, that, I think the other part of that is not, and I definitely agree there's plenty of people not being completely honest and not being transparent about their goals. But I also think the problem is we all have different goals for education. Like, teachers have vastly different goals for what they do every day than what the parents do. And the parents have vastly different goals than what the politicians want. And we all have very different goals than what Pearson wants. So I think that we're a system that is interconnected with a lot of moving pieces and different people and parties involved. And all those parties have different issues. You know, like if you think about like early in the pandemic and we were doing online learning and all these parents are like, oh my God, how do teachers do this every day? Like, we've quickly lost that when the consideration was maybe we should put teachers at the front of the line for the COVID vaccine. No, whoa, no, they don't deserve that. Get out of here. That's madness. Why do teachers get that? That's ridiculous. They're not doing anything important. Like, wait, like 8 months ago, you were writing memes every 5 seconds and putting them on your Facebook page about how hard it was to be a teacher and that your kids are now being taught by day drinking. But we don't deserve the vaccine now that we have your kids in class. Cool. Yeah, that. Glad we remember all the lessons we learned.
Yeah, neat. It's very regional conversations. I mean, where I work, teachers got bumped to the front of the line pretty quickly, and most people in the community were all for it just because they wanted kids back in school. And I don't know, you know, it's always the loudest voices that you hear the most, so it's hard to say what the real sort of opinion in the community is, but the loudest voices wanted kids back in school very badly. So, you know, we got the vaccines pretty quickly, which is great. But yeah, I think we lost a lot of goodwill. There were a lot of people who were, wow, teachers are heroes. I can't believe what they do every day. You know, and I had friends who were telling me, they're like, you can't wait. You're going to see these raises we're going to get next year. This is going to be amazing. And I was like, guys, no, this is going to last. This is going to last like a month. They're going to get sick of this. They're going to say, why aren't you back in school teaching my kid? And then people aren't going to want to pay their taxes, or people are going to lose their jobs. And then they're not going to, but I was like, whether this is a matter of like employment and a tax base, or this is just unhappy parents, I said, you wait, it's going to be a challenge just to get a school budget next year. And in the end, it probably settled in between, but I was more right than they were. They're like, we're going to get these big raises because parents finally appreciate us. And I was like, give it a month, buddy. Come on.
Those are the teachers that haven't been doing it very long. They're like, look, it's going to be great. I'm like, oh, you're so sweet.
That's adorable.
Now, Florida, let's see, right now is March 8th. I got my first dose today. And that was only because they finally allowed us to on Friday. Like, nice. It's been 4 days since we've been allowed to. And yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Cool. It's fine. We've had extra doses that no one's actually been able to distribute. And like, you know, but teachers, nah, we don't need them. That's fine. Yeah. They'll be all right.
See, we got in pretty quick. I mean, I think I got my first dose the end of January and the second one, you know, 2 weeks ago, something like that. But, you know, in Pennsylvania, my parents who are, you know, older and high risk and all, they can't even get in line. Like, so place to place, but the access is different. But also I think the community priorities are different, which, you know, to relate that directly to schools is a fair point. You say parents might want something that isn't exactly what teachers or administrators want. And I think that is a good argument for why we need to cast a wider net, sort of, you know, draw a bigger circle, you know, get more people involved, and not to maybe be cheesy with the rhetoric, but that's one of the things that, say, like a guy like Martin Luther King did really well, was that throughout his career, he included more and more people in what he was talking about. You know, by the time he was assassinated, he's talking about what's best for poor people, regardless of race. He's addressing more issues. And I think that that's something that we need to do in schools, not just with, you know, trying to help more students, but recognizing that we have a lot of stakeholders in the community who do care. And so maybe sort of drawing a circle in a way that allows everyone to sort of offer some input and some ideas into what our goals are and how those processes work. Not that, again, you have to take every piece of advice, but people like to be heard. And sometimes the things that we would hear would probably be productive to help us improve schools.
I agree. I agree. You know, it's always great to have a fellow podcaster on, because when I go off on a tangent, you're able to pull it back to a good conversation.
Perfect. it's like my whole life. That's all I do. I just say a bunch of stuff and go, wait, how'd I start that again?
I like it. Well, now that we're back on track, let's go to my first question for all my guests. And my first question for all my guests, of course, is what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Wow, that's a tricky one. I mean, you could go a lot of different places with it. This is becoming my pet peeve. The more podcasts I record, the more I think that the problem is that we don't have enough flexibility. And when I say choice, I don't necessarily mean like let a kid choose between two or three different books in the classroom. I also don't necessarily mean the idea of like school choice, where, you know, we don't necessarily need to undermine the public system. But if we're really serious about providing education that works well for as many students as possible, then we have to recognize what I think most parents and teachers already know, is that kids learn in different ways, they learn at different speeds, and that, as you pointed out, we have very different goals. And there's no reason that we can't allow greater flexibility within schools to say, you know, a kid maybe spends more time doing projects, someone else likes to sit in the lecture style. I don't think there's anything wrong with promoting a vocational track for students who are interested in it, but it also means that we have to provide that opportunity. So I would love to see more choice in terms of the classes that kids can take or the format of those classes. I would like to see more flexibility. I think that we legislate ourselves into a corner, so to speak, where every kid has to have four Englishes and three maths and four, you know, each of these subject areas, and each one has to have X amount of seat time. And next thing you know, there's so little space for specialization or genuine curiosity that it's really hard to feel like what we're doing is genuine and important. And then we say, you know, well, why is this kid not motivated? Or, you know, like, well, you know, we're running people through a lot of things that in the end are good to know, but aren't necessarily required. You know, we do a lot of things that aren't really going to pay off later for the average person. And again, it doesn't mean you shouldn't learn it. It just means maybe you shouldn't have to learn it in as great a detail. So I would like to see a lot more flexibility in how we operate schools and in the program of studies we offer. I think that would make a lot of people happier and probably lead to a lot more engagement and productivity from students.
You know, I hope that we take a lot of lessons from what we've done for the last year. Let me clarify that. I think there's a lot of things we can learn. And while I see your point of like, if not now, then why ever? I get that a lot. But like, at the same time, this allowed people space I don't think they believed they had before to question a lot of assumptions. And so I hope that maybe we can come out of all of this and learn a couple of things. And one that was talked about in the first episode of my podcast forever ago, is that we don't effectively leverage technology for students. We use it in our classes and stuff, and that's fine. But the problem with the class offering, right? Like, okay, we want to have more classes to offer students. Well, I have to fund it, and I can't fund it unless I can get butts in seats, because kids are dollars in education, and that's really what it comes down to. And if I can't put enough kids in a classroom, I can't afford the teacher that runs the class. And so you can't offer a meteorology class at a school because we certainly can't get 120 high schoolers that want to take meteorology to get a full-time teacher. So you have to get maybe one class worth. And can we really even find 25 kids that want to take meteorology? And so we look at it in these isolated spheres, and it's these silos of schools, and we can't get it done. But if you look at an entire state, I can absolutely find 25, 30, 120 kids who are interested in meteorology. And so why don't we leverage that technology to give us that flexibility? And I hope that we'll be able to take that and do it. Yes. And I'm not all in on the AR/VR bandwagon, but it would allow for a different kind of experience for sure.
Yeah. Since people aren't watching the video, I just held up, I got an Oculus Quest 2 for Christmas after doing an episode of my podcast. And, I just remember I was sitting in, you know, teaching class and then thinking like, man, some of these kids would really do better if they were in the classroom. I thought, why can't we simulate that? And I was like, wait, we could simulate that. Virtual reality exists. And I was like, wait, if I was going to create a, why would I recreate the classroom? Like you could be anywhere. You could be, you know, working on meteorology. You could be in the maps. Yeah. You could have a chemistry lab without actually having to handle any actual chemicals, but you could still do all the stuff. So I've done a couple episodes talking about virtual reality. And I think that that is one of the things that will allow that kind of flexibility. Because to your point, maybe we don't have enough kids in the building, but there are enough kids in the state. So we need someone who can teach it, and you create a virtual space where that can happen. It also keeps your materials costs down. You know, at this point you can get a good VR headset for less than a laptop. And at, you know, so why not put kids in a virtual room or, you know, in a lab setting where they can do these kinds of things. So I think that the technology, to your point, can and should be supporting some of these goals, you know, but I don't know that we're leveraging it all as well as we could. And I don't know that it's fully there yet. You know, I don't know that virtual reality is the way to run a school at the moment, but I think within 5 years, you know, 10 at most, then some of these options become very real, you know, and maybe cost effective to the point where some of it would actually be cheaper to do it virtually than to do it, you know, actually in person with the hardware. So I'm optimistic that some of those ideas will take off. And maybe as some of these kids who have been doing online school and they've realized that, you know, at least parts of it are working for them, they maybe won't be so hesitant to jump into a new activity that would be hosted online because they've already done it, you know, and anything we can do to free up options and let people be creative in how we can deliver those services, I think is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, you touched on it briefly with the idea of the next American relief bill. And the problem I think comes back to funding on this one, because when you're looking at the system, it's easy and great for me to say like, oh, we could find everybody in the state, but that technically a state level class would be taking some money out of the school as it is right now. So as a school leader, I am not encouraged to tell a kid to take a state level virtual course because it now costs me money from my budget. And the way we earmark funds and the way funds work at, and it's different in every state, obviously, but in general, that would be an accurate statement. They're not, budgets aren't run at the state level. Typically they're run at the county level or the district level. And so that would mean that we'd have to come up with some more flexibility in other places as well. So I think ultimately we come back to the idea that we desperately just need the flexibility.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's a self-imposed obstacle, you know, and I think a lot of what we're running into, we're finding that the things that we're doing that are hardest or we're causing the most trouble or we're stressing kids out about a, you know, do you have to take this test or not? You know, admissions exams, do I have to take the SAT or not? Or do we have state tests or not? Or, you know, every one of these things people get to choose. You know, the hardest thing about school should be learning. Like the hardest thing should be for a kid to learn something difficult, to really apply themselves. And the fact that we have so many other things that get in the way, and so many of those things are created either politically or economically, it just says that we can do better. And it doesn't mean we have to be unrealistically idealistic. You know, so some of those hurdles will never disappear. But I think we should probably carefully reassess where those problems are coming from, because a lot of them are only there because we allow them to be.
Yeah. I would argue that the majority of them, if not all of them, are only there because we allow them to be. This whole system is one we all made up.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. I like it. You know what? I'm gonna stamp of approval on that one. We're gonna roll into my next question.
I love it. Thanks. Let me off easy.
Yeah, we're gonna roll into my next one. And my next question for all my guests is, what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
That's tough. I don't like to press that on anybody, like except my students. I don't want to tell anybody else what they have to read unless you're in my class. And even then, I try to give a little choice. I would actually say that a big part of what I think makes me a good teacher, or, you know, at least someone who's interesting to have a conversation with during the school day, is that I read and watch things that are outside of my content area and that are outside of education. Like right now, I'm reading a book called The Tyranny of Merit by Michael Sandel, who's one of my favorite current authors. And he's a philosophy professor at Harvard. And I've read, you know, probably all of his books or most of his books, and it's a brilliant guy. But it really, like, stuff like that forced you to reassess what merit is. And that's an important idea that we have in schools when we think about grading and who gets access to certain things. And so I think that it would be great if people read or watched documentaries, things like that, outside of their content area, and then found ways to work it into their classroom. You know, I do a ton of anthropology and like cultural evolution stuff in my English class. Kids love it. Like the things that we do in class that on the surface have the least to do with English class are sometimes the biggest hits. And so I think that interdisciplinary nature would be good and would come more naturally if people maybe read or watched or listened a little more broadly.
Yeah, I can support that for sure. You know, I listen to an excessive amount of podcasts, and many of them are education, but they're not all education. And very often it's the ideas and the concepts that are not on the education podcast that make their way into my classroom. Like those are the ones that come back to my school and impact my discussions and my decision-making process. And so, yeah, I think it's really, really important. You know, last episode I was talking with Aviva Levin about, you know, one of the things she talked about was trying to tie my ideas back together. It was really cool. I had a great thought and then it's gone. Completely gone. I don't know. It was probably related though. It was probably really cool.
I'm sure it was.
Oh, she talked about how she teaches students, not a subject. And we talked a lot about how like just this obsession with our own subjects or our own content can really cause us to lose track of what we're doing and why we're there. So I think this is also kind of an extension of that, of like, it's not just like you can't be completely dedicated to that singular topic. Like we don't want our students to do that. That's why we give them six classes a day in the middle and high school instead of just yours. Like that's, there's more to it. And if you want to be able to teach them, then you should be a more well-rounded and involved beyond that as well.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we always say we want like big ideas and you maybe build a unit around a big question or an essential question kind of thing. But if we're really serious about that or making real world connections or quote unquote authenticity, which is a pet peeve of mine in education, the idea of authenticity. But if we want to do that, we have to recognize that we have to see how everything connects. And if the teacher doesn't see those connections or can't help the students to find them, then, you know, a lot of times they're going to struggle to do it on their own, at least while they're learning the beginnings and the basics of a subject area. So yeah, I think the more you can enrich what you're doing with diverse texts or materials and ideas, and that not necessarily just culturally, but also like different full on subject areas and things like that. I think that drives a lot of high interest activities and really pushes students to think critically.
Yeah, I agree. I like it. You recommended one book. Do you have any other recommendations for things that are piquing your interest and driving your thoughts these days?
Oh man. It's tricky because most of my quote unquote reading is really audiobooks. I have a long commute. And so when the pandemic hit and I stopped commuting, my reading turned into just a ton of children's books with my kids. But no, The Tyranny of Merit is fantastic. And I think it's something that a lot of teachers should read just because it really forced you to reconsider what we think of in terms of equity and egalitarian sort of principles versus the meritocracy of our society and school. And so that one's good. And it's philosophical, but it's very readable. I loved the book Sapiens, which is, I always switch his first and middle name. Yuval Noah Harari or Noah, but it's like a history of the human species kind of, it does the long view of human development and evolution, which is really, really cool. And then he spins it forward into the next book, which is called Homo Deus, which is like a near future history. And I would say that, or his book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, is really cool because it talks a lot about AI and robotics and the changes we're seeing culturally. And what he does is he does a ton of really good research to sort of predict this is the world we're going to live in 10, 15, or 50 years. And for me, it really had me reassessing the kinds of examples I use with my students because, you know, the world that I'm going to be old in is going to be very, very different than the world we're in right now. And so books like that I think get us thinking about the long view of history are important because too often we make these sort of snap decisions and judgments on what's happening right now. And sometimes having a longer view of both history and the future, I think can create some stability. You know, we see a lot of things changing rapidly and I'm here advocating for change, but none of it should be you know, on a whim, you know, we should be sort of thinking, how does this play out in 50 years? Not as, how does this play out next year? You know, any meaningful change is going to be ugly in the short term. And so you have to really be clear on why you're doing it and how that's going to play out in the long term. So I would recommend some books like that. You know, Sapiens, Homo Deus, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century were really good. Andrew Yang is pretty readable. War on Normal People hits on some of the same ideas. And again, you can take those economic pressures back to your classroom. So those would all be good.
Nice. Awesome. I like it. Cool. I like it. Let's roll into my last one. We're just moving them along. Just
love it.
Just rocking and rolling. I've realized I say rocking and rolling a lot in my show. For a show that has nothing to do with music, I say it quite often.
We had a former principal at my school who used to just tell everyone you rock, to the point where it was sort of started as a joke, but now at every faculty meeting, it's a rock that they spray painted gold, and it gets passed from faculty member to faculty member. And what's funny is now people take it as the great honor to be given the rock, and it totally started as a joke because the guy just told everyone you rock. And so now we have the honorary rock that goes around. Yes, there's a lot of that going on in my school as well.
I like it. It's not a phrase I use in normal life. I only use it in podcasting. I don't know why.
Channeling Casey Kasem.
Yeah, there you go. Holy Toledo, Batman. All right. That was a deep cut, by the way, because he used to be Robin. If you know that. Little known fact. All right, moving on, because I know random facts about Casey Kasem for some reason. So my last question for all my guests, of course, is who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
Oh, man. Can you narrow it down? Can I get like a grade level or a...
No.
That's tough. The greatest teacher I've ever had. Man, that's tough. You know, there's probably like five that jump to mind. And if I got to pick one, we'll probably go recency, because this is the guy who probably got me into the job I'm in. Dr. Mark Faknitz, who was a fantastic English professor at James Madison University. And I was dead set on being a college professor as I was getting towards the end of college. And, you know, I was doing the GREs and all this stuff. And I went and I talked to him, and he wasn't actually my advisor. He I really liked him. I took as many classes with him as I could fit. And he basically explained to me what it was going to be like to be a college professor and how I would be 30 and broke and desperate for a job and all this kind of stuff. He's like, or, you know, he goes, you could probably just go teach high school somewhere and do a lot of the same stuff and just be like a cool high school teacher. And, you know, you'd actually in the long run, you'd probably make more money unless you're going to land a job at, you know, one of the big three or something, you know? and I was like, I don't know, you know, and in the end, that's what happened. But he was fantastic. Really, really smart guy. Very caring of the students. You know, he'd talk to anyone who wanted to talk to him, but he was also one of the toughest professors I had. Like it was not an easy A, but I always appreciated that. So you learn a lot when you're genuinely challenged. And ultimately his advice to think about high school as opposed to college is a big part of why I do what I do now. I think he proved to be right. I think in the end, it was probably a good decision for me overall for just quality of life and things like that. So if I have to pick one, I'll go with Mark Faknitz. But there's a few others who probably belong on that list pretty close behind him.
Nice. Yeah. I like that you became a teacher on an aside by a college professor. Just like, man, this probably just do this, whatever.
That's how I got into education classes. I was like, I'm an English major, and I added an anthropology minor, which I almost became a second major. And then I had, you know, a few classmates who were taking education classes. They're like, you should try it out. I was like, what for? And they're like, there's a fifth year master's, you get to stay for another year. And I was like, another year of college, I'm in, you know. And then education classes are all this sounds terrible, but you know, they're on average, they're pretty easy. So it's a lot of easy A's, and the classes are mostly girls. So I was like, all right, so I'm getting easy grades. There's a lot of cute girls. I'll do this. You know, I get an extra year of college, get a master's degree. And then by the time I had that conversation with him and student taught, at that point, it was a done deal. You know, now I love what I do. But a lot of it was was done for either by accident or for, you know, borderline wrong reasons.
Yeah. I did not at all want to spend another year in college. So I cannot relate to that in any way. I was so ready to be done.
Really?
Much like high school, I was ready to be done with that too. So
yeah, I was ready to be done high school. I, that I always joke that that's my greatest regret. The worst thing I ever did was leave college. You know, if I, I should have Van Wildered that thing. I should still be taking classes. Like that would have been the way to go.
No, I did not at all. And then I kind of like fell into a master's program and that was even worse. It was so much worse. I hated it so much. And like the worst part is I didn't pay for like undergrad. I had scholarships and money and whatever. It didn't cost me anything. And my master's cost me a significant amount of money. And I didn't like it. I hated it. Like it wasn't fun.
Yeah.
And why did I pay all that money to not have fun?
That's a good question. See, for me, that was actually, I was a much better student in college than high school. I was a good student in high school, but I was much better in college. And the whole thing was now I'm paying for it. Like I used to, my alarm would go off and I'd be like, I don't think I'm going to class today. And it would just flash into my head. Like, idiot, you're paying for this. And I would get up and go. Like I could count in 5 years, you know, 5.5 years, count the masters. I could probably count on my fingers and toes the total number of classes I missed, like through all the time. Not because I wanted to go to them all, just because I thought, like, what kind of dummy pays for this and then doesn't show up? And so, you know, I think I got the most out of it that I could. And my only regret is that I didn't stretch it out a little bit longer.
That works. Awesome. Well, Ryan, man, I really appreciate your time. This is a lot of fun. I had a good time.
Yeah, this is great. Fantastic. Great questions. I took your advice and came in cold, and that was really good. And a professional interviewer, whatever rust you were worried about, long gone.
Like a full on pro. I didn't accidentally hit a back button in the middle of recording and have to start in the middle again.
It's like
that didn't happen.
It's like riding a bike. Into the bushes.
Yeah, exactly. Directly into a pile of trash at the AC's house. Oh, that's a deep cut for my dad. He'll get that. It's fine. All right. Anyways, I'm done. I'm punch drunk over here. All right. Well, I appreciate your time, Ryan. Thank you so much. For my audience, if they'd like to connect with you more, hear what you're doing, where can they find you?
So you can check out the ClassCast podcast on all major streaming services. I'm on Twitter at ClassCastPod, on Facebook and Instagram at ClassCastPodcast. And there's also a contact form on the website. So www.classcastpodcast.com.
Awesome. All right. Links to all those, of course, in the show notes, as always. And so swipe up, swipe down, left, right, whatever it is, swipe in a direction and find the notes. I don't know. Maybe click a button. I don't know how your podcast player works. That's on you, not me. And so that's what I got. I appreciate your time, Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me. And I will talk to you later.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining me on the show and for the great conversations in our Twitter DM group. To connect with Ryan, find him on Twitter at ClassCastPod. Also, check out his podcast at his website, ClassCastPodcast.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts, maybe where you're listening to this one. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram at Brad Schreffler. I'd love to hear from you all there, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website that gives you other options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, remember that it doesn't matter if you remember every workout. It matters that you went.
Music for the Planning Period Podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.org. The Planning Period Podcast is a proud member of the On Podcast Media Network. You can hear other great shows by hosts such as Mike Washburn, Glenn Irvin, Dan Krynas, and many more by visiting onpodcastmedia.com. The Planning Period Podcast is also a member of the VoiceEd Radio Network. You can hear this show and tons more, including regular live interviews about education, at voiceed.ca. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.